with someone about something you can't talk about with anyone else, you can talk to us. I'm Dr. Susan Block, your mistress of the airwaves, but my day job is director of the Dr. Susan Block Institute for the Erotic Arts and Sciences, specializing in sex therapy over the phone. Anytime you need to talk, whether you need serious psychotherapy or a hot phone sex experience, or a combination, my world-renowned telephone sex therapists are just a phone call away. Totally private, absolutely confidential. We listen, talk with you, advise you, role-play for you, fantasize with you, no fantasy is too taboo, and help you with anything from impotence to exhibitionism, fears to desires, fetishes to marriages. For more information, call us at 213-291-9497. That's 213-291-9497 anytime you need to talk.
You're listening to Radio Susie One on the World Wide Web. And now, here she is, Dr. Susan Block.
Brothers and sisters, lovers and sinners, artists and exhibitionists, voyeurs and connoisseurs, all you children of sex, and we all are children of sex, with a capital X. Can I hear an amen?
Amen.
Can I hear an A women?
A women!
I want to welcome you to the new Bonoboville at LAX, with a capital X. As a matter of fact, it's LAX triple X. Well, sometimes. Tonight, if you're listening to us live, tonight we are celebrating the 70th Scorpio birthday of our illustrious and beloved and notorious executive producer, Prince Maximilian Rudolf Leblevich de Lubkowitz de Filangeri, also known as Captain Max, a.k.a. Massimiliano, a.k.a. Massimo, a.k.a. Mickey, a.k.a. Speck, a.k.a. my husband. And we are also celebrating 42 years of revolutionary, groundbreaking publishing in Southern California. Max is, of course, besides happening to be my husband of 21 years, he is the pre-internet pioneer of reader-written media. How about that? You know what reader-written media is? It's everything on the internet. And he was doing it first with the LA Star, Love Magazine, Finger, God the Magazine, Annie Sprinkles Hot Shit, Beverly Hills the Magazine. That's right. And the Brentwood Blah Blah. And Dr. Block's Journal. My captain, your captain. Let's hear it for happy birthday, Captain Max. Woo-hoo!
Thank you, Doc. Thank you very much. Thank you very much. Turn it up a little bit for me, guys. A little bit.
So,
turn up my mic a little bit. Turn up. Thank you very much for turning
Captain,
up my mic.
I am a captain with you tonight.
So,
in your honor.
That was quite an introduction.
I got it out of the press release.
It made me very nervous. Extremely nervous.
Well, this is a special birthday. And besides, I don't have any other guests tonight. So, okay. By the way, if you came to drsusie.tv, if you came to join, because of Catherine and Sam, you can watch three shows with Sam and four with Catherine on drsusie.tv. But if you came for the captain, this is going to be all captain for 90 minutes.
For 90 minutes.
Yeah, I think. God. Well, maybe we'll meander into something else. But, I mean, I kind of want to go over your amazing life in one. I'm going to see if I can do it. I tried to write it up.
Oh, you did?
Yeah. This is the beginning of a book, actually, okay. That, I mean, since I didn't give you a present this year or any year.
I have the greatest present I've ever been given by your mom.
Yeah, well, my mom gave you a present. Me.
Right, yeah.
But, you know, I'm always just living and breathing you, so I don't know about presents. But this is the beginning of my book about you.
Okay.
Okay, right. So I'm going to interview you.
Fair enough. Okay,
for
go
this,
ahead. Fair enough. Fair enough.
So are you ready?
I am ready.
Is an element of fantasy.
Okay.
Right. And by the way, I should add that if you're listening or watching, if you're on Skype, you can contact us through, Dr. Susie TV.
That's
and
right.
And if you want to call us, it's 1-866-289-7068 or 310-568-0066. That's a lot of sixes because we are demonic. And you can also tweet us at Radio Susie One on Twitter. So, happy birthday, Max. So your first birthday was in a Roma. You're a Roman.
My first birthday was in Rome. It was during the Second World War. And I was born in a hospital that is almost basically attached to the Vatican.
Mm-hmm.
And it's actually where they take the popes.
The popes.
When
you
something
and the
happens.
Popes.
Yeah. So
wow. The
reason I was there is because I was born in the middle of the Second World War. And there was a lot of shooting and things going on. And
bombs dropping.
That, no, they didn't bomb Rome.
No.
Rome was like a... And the reason they put me in the hospital there is because they thought if they should bomb Rome...
You'd
then
be safe.
They'd be safe because they wouldn't be bombing the Vatican.
The little prince would be safe.
Right. In those days, they didn't have the smart missiles that missed their... target.
Right, right.
So today you could
guns.
They just had these cannons and guns, and they didn't have any of this smart equipment. So it was nobody was supposed to bomb the Vatican because the Vatican is a separate country.
Right, right. You were in sacred land.
Right. Italy has a couple of different countries in it. San Marino,
and besides,
the
there was a lot of Italians in, the U.S., and certainly, I mean, FDR didn't want to lose the Italian vote. Wasn't going to bomb the Vatican.
I guess not, no.
Even if the Pope did support Hitler.
So like many children after I was born, many of the wealthier families actually sent their kids away. They sent them either to Switzerland, where they were breastfed by big Swiss mamas.
Yeah.
And spent a portion of the war in the Alps.
And were you there, like Heidi in the Alps?
I was there in the Alps, yes, yes. And I have very vague memories of it. Very vague memories of this farm on a slope in the Alps.
Eating lots of cheese.
Getting cheese, as Willem de Ridder says, getting a cheese brain, like the Dutch have.
So when did your brain start to come back to civilization?
They brought me back to Italy, probably 1947, 46, when the war ended around that time.
Yeah.
And I had been told all this time when I was in Switzerland that my dad had died in the war.
Mm-hmm.
So when I came back, they said, well, your dad is not he's not dead, and he was in hiding, and because the Nazis were after him, and the fascists were after him, and he was a spy, it turns out.
Uh-huh.
He was a spy for American intelligence.
Now, which dad was this?
This was Peter.
Peter Lubkowitz.
Peter Francis Lubkowitz.
Right. Yes, of the, Prince of Prague, Duke of
Fine,
Melnick.
Of the fine Czechoslovakian family.
Lubkowitz right, family, right.
We're really a small part of it, but we're of the Lubkowitz family. That's the title is the Lubkowitz. Lubkowitz is actually the title.
Yes, I am wearing a Lubkowitz pin in my hat right now.
So all the Lubkowitzes actually have different names, but they're of Lubkowitz. Or
let me see which is
von Lubkowitz. Or,
right, this one. This one is the Lubkowitz pin.
Shield.
Where did I get that? Did you give that to me, or did I like steal
no,
it from
your,
you?
No, your brother brought that back from the Czech Republic, and it's one of those things that they sell over there to tourists.
Okay. Yeah. So that's not so special. But I also have on a Lubkowitz ring, and you gave me.
That I gave you.
Of course, they also sell this to tourists. So
yeah, well, they'll sell that to anybody if you want to get a ring like that.
Yeah, it's got the crest. Narrow,
right, it's got the crest.
And what does it mean to be the Prince of Prague?
Nowadays, it means that you can't even get reservations at McDonald's. Okay. But at one time, and as I was growing up, it was amazing in traveling around the country and that the response to these things. I was the Principality of Monaco when I was a hippie. I was driving a van with Lady Luck painted on the back. And I, actually, to this day, I don't know what I
Lady
actually,
Luck?
Yeah, Lady
that
Luck.
Sounds like Vegas or something.
Yeah,
oh, well, but it's Monaco. Okay, Monte Carlo.
They have, they have things. So anyway, so the police pulled me over, and I don't really know why to this day. And but what happened was, is that because I was a foreigner, they made me go to the police station to pay my fine. And so I followed them there, and I got to the police station. And I got out of the van, and they took me into I guess the head cop there, who was sitting behind this desk counter type thing, and they spoke a little bit in French and I guess about what my vehicle crime was, you know, and the man behind the desk looked at me, and he spoke English, and he said, "Could I please see your driver's license?" So I said, "Well, certainly, of course, I have a driver's license." And I hand him the driver's license, and he looks at the driver's license, and he looks at me, and he stands up, and he salutes me.
Prince.
And he turns around to the police officer that brought me in and starts, like, going, "You idiot! What have you done? Hmm. You brought it, you know." So there were many apologies. I was like, okay, this is great. And they apologized, and I went on my way. There were many, there's many instances like that until, and even to this day, the really big families, the well, like the British royal family, the Dutch royal family. You know, most of Europe are still monarchies.
Sure, they keep their monarchs around,
right,
unless they get too many shoes.
But even then, I mean, you know, they keep their monarchs around. It stabilizes the society and the culture. They feel.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, they feel that there's a long running. Somebody is watching after them.
Hmm.
You know. And it's not, media has made it that the monarchs were horrible people, and some of them were, you know, definitely. We had some horrible presidents here who killed a lot of people. So, you know, power brings about a lot of mayhem and death.
But there's something about democracy that makes you feel like there's a chance of fairness. When it's all monarchy, it's like you just, you know, gotta marry well.
Well, it depends where the democracy is. I mean, the democracy here in the United States is a useless democracy. It has nothing to do with with the first democracy, by the way, in the world was in Switzerland 700 years ago.
Mm.
We tend to take the credit for it. But the oldest democracy is, of course, Switzerland.
Well, I guess some of these European countries, they have kind of this combination at this point. They have the democracy with their, you know, prime minister and...
The democracy sits on top of an elected democratic...
And then they have some queen or other that kind of wears a lot of jewels and
rides around in a chariot and costs a lot of money.
Yes, costs a lot of money.
I
and
mean,
people,
gazillions of dollars.
I don't know. I mean, I guess some people like it and some people don't. It's a point of controversy.
So,
but anyway, where's our chariot? Where's our? Why don't we get any of this?
Why?
We got booted out by so much the Nazis as the communists.
The communists decimated the Lobkowitz family.
Although now there's all these beer establishments.
Yes,
Lobkowitz beer.
Because Lobkowitz beer, I believe, goes back to the 1400s. It's one of the oldest beers. And the Lobkowitzes got their title because they were under the Austro-Hungarian, the Habsburgs. They were the major sheep herders.
Right.
And so they provided wool and commerce,
shepherds,
to the Czech Republic, and
very biblical.
For that, they were honored with a title. That's how everybody got their titles.
With money.
With money, economic power.
Yeah.
And the first ones, of course, just declared themselves that. You know, because it was their land, and they ruled over it, and they, so they're kings, you know.
There you go.
So, but having a title, or being a blue blood, in the early days of my life, was really quite nice. You had a lot of privileges that you don't have now.
It also means high forehead.
Yeah, Lobkowitz means a big forehead.
Big forehead, which you have, interestingly.
Right. Lobe.
Lobe.
Yeah,
right.
That's a big forehead.
It's a nice way of saying bald, perhaps.
Well, actually, it's supposed to mean that you're very intelligent and smart.
You have all these brains.
You have all this brain matter behind your
big head.
Your bald,
right.
big
that's
head.
That's what I think, yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Okay, so back to you, and there you are in, where are you? You're in Rome or Napoli?
I'm in Rome, and I'm taken to... I'm taken to...
Convent or to a school?
I'm taken to... I went to live with my... I grew up with all women. My great-grandmother, my grandmother, my mother, and my aunt.
And this is your other royal side, which is...
That's the Filangeris.
Your maternal royal side, the Filangeris, who are the kings and queens of Napoli.
Yes, and they the Filangeris were originally French, and they lived in the south of France. And then, of course, there were the Crusades. And
this is why I think Max is related to Jesus.
They decided to hightail it to Italy. And what actually Filangeri means, figli di Angeri.
But why did they decide to hightail it to Italy? We've got to explain this.
Because
some people in the south of France, these people, believed that they were descendants of Jesus.
Jesus, right.
That Mary Magdalene had been his wife, and the Da Vinci Code, of course, picks up on this. And she sailed to the south of France when she had a daughter instead of a son who could lead the revolution. And she sailed from Egypt to the south of France, and there she settled and... You know, had a daughter, and she married and intermingled with the people there, and then you know, when the church became huge, they just hated the fact that there were these people in the south of France that said, "Well, you know, you guys
claim to be relative.
Say that Jesus is God and everything, but we say that he's our great great grandfather." That's a bit of a problem when you're saying that Jesus is this celibate, you know, paragon of godliness. So they're one of the crusades against Christians, because these people consider themselves Christians.
Right.
They kind of just thought, you know, it's kind of the family religion, mm-hmm. Christianity, mm-hmm. you know, right. being in, but they didn't call it Christianity. I don't know what they called it, but they were like into Jesus because they thought he was their great-great-grandfather. So when they started to kill these people, some of them fled to Italy. And
yes, we,
that's why they
we
are called Filangieri, right. Sons of Angeri.
Sons of Angeri. And as they say today, the family split for Italy. And they went to Naples, and they became very powerful in Naples. This was in the 1100s, by the way. That's how far back I can basically trace my family. They became
Gaetano Filangieri is your yeah. ancestor, and he, of course, was one of the advisors to Benjamin Franklin.
That is correct. During the writing,
and Thomas Jefferson.
Thomas Jefferson during the writing of the Constitution of the United States.
Don't worry, we're going to get to all the porn and stuff.
Yeah, but, he was. he was a philosopher of the Enlightenment. And along with the great French philosophers.
But you do have a very illustrious background in publishing.
Yes, because, of course, the family was publishing then. He wrote, he was the first one in the family to really write this series of political books. And there were six of them, I believe, before he died. He died very young. But what is interesting about this man is that he brought Italy out of the Dark Ages, basically. And some of the things that he was concerned with, and like he would in his writings, he says that no government, no society can survive unless it has respect for its environment.
Wow!
So he was environmentalist.
He was definitely ahead of his time.
Way ahead of his time. And he saw this coming. He also was the man that theorized the balance of power that we use today. And his theories are used at West Point and military schools. The balance of power, he theorized because each part of Italy was a kingdom of some sort. And so in order to try to have peace, they would make these alliances.
Mm-hmm.
So it's like having a nuclear bomb.
Right.
I have one, you have one, so let's not throw it at each other. In essence, that's kind of what the balance of power is.
But meanwhile, the U.S. had just thrown a bomb, you know,
yeah,
after the war, and there you are.
But let me finish. The other things that he was very involved in was the compulsory education of children,
mm-hmm.
which, of course, I'm totally
against.
Totally against. My three children never went to school until...
Right. That's why they're feral.
Yeah. so he was for that. He also prison reform. Just many things that today we basically take for granted.
Mm.
And the founding father...
Well, you're for prison reform. Well, then they had dungeons or something.
Yeah. They had people in dungeons, which in a way might have been better, actually.
Oh, you think?
Yeah, compared to some of the prisons, the high-security prisons that we have today.
Well, they could possibly put as many people in those dungeons put into the prisons nowadays.
No.
Dungeons are kind of kinky anyway.
And the Filangieris were also the partners of the Rothschilds. They represented the Rothschild Bank in Italy.
So where's our money?
Which was, my grandfather spent most of it. Mm. The family.
Right, he had his own train. Or
he collected train cars. He collected armor. He had his own. He had a dining car, and he had a sleeper car.
And he collected women.
And he had a salon car. And he was a great pianist, and he never worked a day in his life. And the family owned the Perrier of Italy at the time,
mm-hmm.
Filangieri water, Filangieri pasta, Filangieri wines, which were called the tears of Christ.
The tears of Christ, white wine, I guess. Or
no.
Actually, he cries blood.
Right,
so
blood.
The red wine.
The tears of Christ. And their main villa was in Naples, and the main villa was maintained by 32 servants. You could order anything you wanted 24 hours a day from the kitchen downstairs that burned wood-burning stoves. And that was the main villa. And then they had hotels. He had, I think, 11 other estates. But he never worked a day in his life. He was a fascist. He was a supporter of Mussolini. And when he died a communist. And he said to me, Miki, that was my nickname, Miki, Massimo, I don't leave you much except for a tradition. And that's where all that stuff went. It went to women.
All right. Yep. A tradition of giving stuff to women.
To women. That's correct. And
that's what it's all about. That's the Phil and Jerry tradition.
I always found that noble.
And you were surrounded by women because the men were off and about with other women.
With other women. Right. I think my grandfather had, I don't know how many children among the maids and servants that he had, including a family member who had a Jewish nanny. Many
years Jewish ago. The Jewish theme comes up in your life.
Had a Jewish nanny, and she got pregnant. And, of course, you know, the Jews weren't really okay in those times. But this man, instead of disowning or saying, no, this is not my child, this Jewish child is not my child, he married her.
Aww.
Yeah, he married her.
And, really cool.
So somewhere in there we got some Jewish blood, and it maybe explains why over the years I always found Jewish people really interesting and fascinating. And
Jewish girls especially.
And especially Jewish girls, correct.
Right, but we're jumping ahead to Montclair, New Jersey, and we haven't left Napoli, and we have to tell the nun story.
When I went first to school.
Although I do want to just add, and I don't know if we want to go into this in detail, but your parentage, although it is Phil and Jerry Lefkowitz, is a little bit vague and mysterious.
Yeah, like all good families, it's all vague and mysterious. a lot of it hiding secrets of the family, a lot of tremendous amount of infighting within the families. Over wealth, over titles, and this kind of thing. So after staying with my women relatives, my aunt and my grandmother and my great grandmother, one day I was told that my father actually was alive, and the war, I think, was almost over, not quite over. But I do recall that we went to this hotel and we went up to the back stairs to meet him. So obviously somebody was still looking for him. And I don't know if this is a dream but somehow I recall a tremendous gunfight.
Right.
Tremendous
You've
gunfight.
You've told me about that, yeah.
It
does sound dreamy, but you were so young.
Yeah,
you know, memories like that are very dreamy anyway.
And my mother had me in the stairwell, and she was covering me,
trying to shield you.
Shield
from the situation.
Me, and we didn't really know. I guess she didn't know. I certainly don't know to this day what was going on. But a little while later, we went down the hallway. There was no dead people in the hallway or blood.
Well, that's good.
And
we
actually ran down the hallway because we didn't know what was going on. There he was. My father opened the door.
Peter.
And I remember I was a little kid just kind of staring up at him. And my mom going, "This is your father." And I looked at him and I said, "Hello, Daddy." I guess. I don't know what I did. But from then on, we were together as a family. And and then I was told that we were going to America.
Skipping the nun story.
Oh, the nun story, yes. So when they brought me back when I was five to I guess they wanted to send me to school, and I lived on a street called Via Monte di Dio, in the Avenue of God. I lived, and right across the street was the Catholic, school with the nuns. And my grandmother owned the building. It was this beautiful building that she had with the vineyards in the back. Pretty stunning stuff. Anyway, they sent me over there, and I got, and they had the door. It's not like schools today. The little wooden doors to come in, to get in. So I got there, and the nun opened the door. And I said, I don't want to go in here. I forget who it was. My mom, I think. I said, I don't want to go in here. No, and I started to cry, and I started to kick, and I just did everything possible not to go into there. But anyway,
first act of rebellion. Yeah, that you remember.
I had to stay there. So lunchtime. We sat down, and I had my frock on, you know, my little black dress on and my big white bow. And I was very Little Massimo, his first day at school. And so lunchtime, we could go play after we ate our whatever it was, soup, I remember. Part of it was soup. And so I took the soup and I poured it under the table. And
I thought you poured it in your pocket.
Well, part of it went in my pocket. Part of it went in the...
it went through your pocket.
On the floor. But anyways, once I did that, I immediately got up and went out into the yard.
Leaking soup.
And made my way out of this place that had these strange people that with white, which I'd always seen on the street, and really thought they were rather strange folks.
The nuns were very decked out then,
right,
their black and white.
The black and whites, and like cops, you know, the black and whites. And so I ran back, and there was ran back to my mother's, my grandmother's house, and we lived on the second floor, and there's these beautiful marble stairs going up there, and at the top of it is is a huge statue, and I forget what it was exactly, but it was right at the front door, and I would hide behind it many times just to have my little secret place. And I ran over there, and so I went missing. And so there was a big, where's little Massimo?
And you were hiding behind the statue.
Massimo's missing. He's not in class. Where is he? He's not on the grounds. So this committee of nuns came over, and they're walking up kind of the stairs, and I'm like looking at these guys. There's like three or four of them. And when they got to the top of the stairs, I tried to push them down.
And you were like 5 years old.
I was just so upset at these people. And anyway, so I was too tiny, but my grandmother came out, and
revolutionary at 5 years old.
And it was clear already that I was nothing but trouble.
All right. And then trouble went sailing. So, I mean, in my kind of overview of your life, part one is in Italy, you know, with that trip to the Alps.
But wait a minute. First I left.
Oh, wait a minute. We forgot an Italy part.
I left Italy. And I had to go to these American military bases.
This was before you set sail for America.
Yeah, to get permissions and do all kinds of things. So I was just amazed by these military trucks and, you know, soldiers marching around and that kind of thing. And then finally, the day came. I was 7 years old, and we went to the harbor. We were packed up, and we boarded this incredible ship. I was a little boy, and this thing was huge to me. It was like a monster. It was big.
Yeah, and this really became kind of a theme of your life. I mean, here we are celebrating Captain Max, and I'm not sure, you know.
I made my way.
What you were else you were a captain of, but you were the captain of that ship.
I can remember boarding that ship as if it was yesterday, the excitement. And the excitement of going to a land that I had no concept of. You know, it was just, it's the new land. It's America.
New land. It's a new life. Land. Exciting. New life. Adventure. It's like going to another planet.
Right. So we went on board. I had my own room. My parents had their room. And I made the sailing with the remaining royals of the Italian monarchy, which had been also overthrown.
Oh, so you had all these royal children on
yes,
the ship.
Right, and there's a wonderful picture of me with all these beautiful little white kids, you know, all these royal kids, well-dressed, and there I am right next to the princess, and it was very...
Yes, I've seen that picture. We have to find it.
I don't know what happened
everything.
To
it. We have a lot of boxes to still unpack.
And
at nighttime,
the ship was just full of dancing and parties and up in first class. And I would sneak out of my room, you know, and run around the ship, and I'd get myself hooked up under the bridge and just watch that ship move through the darkness and as it went into the water. And I fell in love with ships, and I thought,
right,
one day I am going to be the captain of a ship.
And you are.
Yes.
Of course, we're not sailing on the water. We're sort of sailing around on...
It's a ship
the ground.
In mud, sort
yeah,
of.
Yeah, stuck in the mud.
Mud.
Well, some ships
yeah.
are,
some, you know.
We're
some
docked,
ships are, yeah.
right?
Some ships are.
So,
and I came and I arrived in New York, and we went through customs.
Did you get to Ellis Island?
No, we didn't go
oh,
there.
Oh, okay,
no.
You didn't have to go there. You were royal.
Way too fine people to go there. So we never went to Ellis Island. We went into the harbor, and we disembarked. And I remember it was very easy. We were met by some people, some men, who basically took us through everything and to outside. And I saw that my first American cabs, which looked like armored personnel carriers. They were so big.
Big.
You know, 1950s, yellow cabs. And I was just fascinated. Anyway, we got loaded up. They had a place for us to stay. And we were in the cab with my mother and myself. And my mother is looking out the window. We're all looking out the window at these immense, huge buildings. And my mother said to my father... She said, why does everybody, how come in New York everybody is selling salt?
Oh.
And my father said, what do you mean, salt?
It says sale.
She says, well, everywhere in all the windows, it says
sale,
which in sale, or sale in Italian means means salt. And so she was quite amazed that these rich Americans were selling salt.
And you didn't speak English when you first arrived.
No, I didn't speak English. And we went to, we lived in New York City for a couple of weeks. And then we moved to Glenridge, New Jersey, which was at the time one of the richest cities in the country, right next to Montclair, New Jersey. And we moved to Glenridge, and... I couldn't speak English, but my brother got a new baby carriage because he was really young, and I proceeded to dismantle this beautiful carriage and sell it off.
All right, the entrepreneurial instincts were setting in.
That was my first business deal. I sold this my brother's carriage. No wonder he hates me. You know.
Yeah. Well, on that note, I think we should cut away to a little commercial break because we're going to come back. And guess what? Massimo is going to have his first sexual experiences. Right? Well, I mean, I don't know. Maybe you had a few before, but I think we're going to start talking about
that. I had actually in Italy. I had a girlfriend that we would go visit. And, you know,
when you were five or six?
Yeah, five, six, actually. Uh-huh. Right before coming to America.
Yeah.
And we had these friends, and I would, we would go over to their house, and they had a beautiful girl that was my age.
Aw.
Yeah. So we would go under the bed. They had those big, high, old-fashioned iron beds. And we would slide under the bed, and the covers, you know, the would cover to the floor. And we would play doctor.
Doctor.
There. Yeah.
Not doctor. Post office. You were more sophisticated.
No,
than
we
that.
Played doctor. We wanted to see what was wrong in there.
Were you the doctor or the patient?
I was the doctor.
You were the doctor, never the patient.
No.
The roles are slightly reversed these
days.
But
the patient wanted to see what the doctor had, of course.
Of course. You know, well, you know.
How he got to be a doctor.
Yes, yes. Your credentials.
Right. Credentials.
So, okay. Well,
that was my first.
And you told me that you never went through a period of not liking girls.
I never. And when I grew up, you know how little boys
often go through a period where girls are yucky and have cooties.
I never had that because of, I guess, I grew up with women and they were all so sweet and nice to me, you know.
Right.
I was the magical kid. I could do no wrong.
But when we come back, we're going to get into your first, I guess, ejaculations, you know, because that's what's different, you know, masturbatory and interactive. Max is going to get very active sexually suddenly.
Suddenly.
So we're going to cut to a little commercial. I don't hear my music.
We're going to get a drink. We're going to hear some music.
Yeah.
Because we're cutting to the commercial.
Right. I need to hear that music. There we go. There it is. And if you'd like to tweet at us, you can tweet at Radio Suzy1, RadioSuzy1 on Twitter, or give us a call at 310-568-0066. And we're going to be back with more of Captain Max's life. So don't come yet and don't go away. We'll be right back.
...of religious sexual abuse? Has your sex life been hurt, warped, or excessively repressed by a strict religious anti-sex upbringing? Are you concerned that an unhealthy fundamentalist or orthodox environment is distorting or destroying your sexuality, your marriage, or your life in general?
No,
the Dr. Susan Block Institute specializes in treating victims of religious sexual abuse. For information about our telephone sex therapy services, call 1-866-207-7521 or 213-291-9497. That's 1-866-207-7521 or 213-291-9497. You won't go to hell for it, but you just might feel a lot better.
You're listening to Radio Suzy One on the World Wide Web. And now, here she is, Dr. Susan Block.
And we're back. I'm Dr. Susan Block, your mistress of the airwaves, your pleasure preacher. And I like to practice what I preach. And so I married the love of my life because it gives me pleasure. And it's his birthday, Captain Max. So tonight, I am delving into your life. And we're only at about age 8 years old, and we're halfway through the show. So how are we going to get through the other, like, 60-something years? We have to kind of move right along.
We'll do a little chapter next time.
Yeah, we could do that.
Yeah, yeah.
Okay, so we don't have to finish your life.
No, please.
Well, please, no, of course not. So where were we? We were in New Jersey.
And, New Jersey.
And your first sexual experiences.
Well.
Meaning your first mature, you know, coming of age sexual.
So I was just standing on a corner in Montclair, New Jersey, and to be specific, North Mountain Avenue. And just down the street from my house. And there were a bunch of kids talking. And one of them said, well, have you ever, you know...
Jerked off?
Jerked off.
Did they say jerked off? Or
I forget what they used.
Jacked off? Or?
Yeah, it wasn't masturbate.
No.
You know, it's just... I guess this kid was explaining that he started to play with his penis. And... something, yeah, he wanted to know, something weird happened.
Ah. Oh.
The stuff shot out of it.
I mean, they didn't have sex education then.
Right. So.
And they didn't have porn that you could see, you know, so easily. I mean, nowadays, young people do learn it before they do it very often.
Well,
they see it on the internet.
Right, we didn't.
So you didn't know. You didn't know what the stuff was.
No. And this kid didn't know.
As much as you could say that porn is bad for kids, at least it teaches you sort of what this stuff is.
So we were all kind of like, but he was saying, no, it feels good. I mean, it's not like it doesn't feel good. It feels very good. So we were all kind of, and how did that work? How did you do this? And here we are on the street corner talking about this very seriously. Mm-hmm. I said, well, got hard, you know?
Yeah.
Do yours get hard? Well, yeah, they get hard. Well, then I started to to play with it. And he says, and the more I played with it, the better it was. And so... I listened to this whole thing, and I went back, and I started to explore this idea of playing with my penis, and nothing happened, you know. And then finally one night, I was playing with it, and there was terror in my heart.
Terror.
Because I felt something... was
rumbling.
Rumbling.
Ready to
inside
explode.
Inside of me. And so I stopped and I started and I stopped and I started. And then I just kept going and I said, okay. He said, you know, this, and it felt good. And what I didn't expect was that this, he didn't really tell about the shooting of this thing.
Right, the propulsion.
The propulsion part of it. So this
that
thing,
it might land on furniture or something.
Yes, or on my bed, and you know, he didn't tell me that. So here it expelled, and
maybe his just dribbled.
I don't know.
And yours was, you know.
But I thought, okay, this is really strange. I'm going to have to do this again. So I started masturbating about 3 times a day, and but I didn't.
And
know,
how old were you?
You know, I want to say I was 12, 13 at that point, somewhere there. And I was still in junior high school. So I must have been in 8th grade.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, so there was this stuff that expelled
right
out of it.
What to do with that?
What to do with that?
Was the key.
So the key was, So I started taking, you know, writing paper. And I would come in the writing paper, and then I would crumple
that's
it.
That's kind of rough. No,
yeah, but
no Kleenex or toilet paper?
Well, that came later.
Yeah, okay.
So I would crumple it up, and I would throw it out my window.
There you go. Not in the trash.
Not in the trash, because I didn't, you know, it was like, I didn't want anybody finding it there. And I thought,
not in the trash, but you threw it in your front lawn or your back lawn?
No, the side of the house.
Of the house.
I thought, well, if it's at the side of the house, I can deny knowledge of what this is. If it's in my wastebasket, I can't.
Okay.
So one day...
Very good logic for a 12-year-old.
The maid came upstairs, Maria, and she knocked on my door. And yes, and she said, you know,
Massimo.
Massimo. There's all this crumpled paper.
In the bushes.
In the downstairs. And she said, I picked it all up. But she says, what you want to do is use tissue.
Nice. Very nice.
And you should go to the bathroom to do...
And throw it in the trash.
And I was so humiliated.
Oh, I bet.
You know, but it was a great idea.
It was. It was very nice. It could have been a lot worse.
Yeah,
it was a great idea. She could have told you you're going to hell. She could have yelled at you. She could have said, I'm going to tell your father.
So I was doing it so often that one day, and what I would do is I would sit in reverse on the toilet. Not
mounting the toilet.
Mounting the toilet.
As if it's a lover.
Yeah. So then my father came in one day. I somehow had left the door.
Oh, God. That's even more embarrassing. I'm surprised you're not more crazy from this.
And he walked in and he said, oh, excuse me. And he closed the door and then I came out. And and he said, so what? And my father was very open.
Very open, right. So, he had a bidet.
Yeah,
right. Back in Montclair, New Jersey in the 50s, he had a bidet. Right. Nobody had a bidet.
And presenting it to the mayor and
right.
all the social people.
Oh, yes,
people.
Yes, in a party.
At a party. So he said...
Showing everyone how it works.
He says, why are you masturbating that way?
So you were inhibited even though you had a father like that. Because of the New Jersey culture.
It was then that I kind of opened up and realized
right.
that my father was really quite
cool,
pretty cool.
And then you became, a crusader for sexual freedom, the right to have a bidet.
I'm drinking.
And you're drinking an interesting beer out of an interesting glass. It's like
very nice.
A beer glass jar attempting to be a wine glass. It's like one of our jars.
No, this has a bottom to it.
I know. Did they glue it on?
No, I think...
Is that how it came?
I think the people have been drinking out of these
people
jars.
People have been drinking out of these jars like us. I thought
finally,
we were the only ones.
Marketing department said, hey...
Let's make them elegant.
Yeah, let's make them.
And they look kind of weird.
They're quite
but,
nice.
But, they're kind of nice.
The bottoms are a little small.
Yeah, that's the thing, is they should make a more flared bottom.
If you're drunk.
But anyway, we can't, Lubkovitz beer should make their own version.
So.
So you're in New Jersey, and your dad is a kind of an odd but very strong.
No.
Crusader himself for sexual expression.
He's just
freedom of expression.
He's just he's just having sex with as many women as he can find.
Right. Affairs,
right. Affairs.
And does your mother know?
Or? My mother really doesn't know.
You think?
I think. Right. But she knew.
She knew.
Because she was very sad many times.
Mm-hmm. And you think that was why?
She would be crying and I could never find out. Why should she would be crying?
Aww.
You know.
Yeah.
And I became a very big Elvis fan. I loved Elvis.
Mm-hmm. You had a lot of pictures of him on your walls.
So I had two rooms. I actually had three rooms in my house. I had the room up in the attic where the servants were. It was like a bedroom. I had a bedroom on the second floor, and then I had a veranda, a glassed-in. Big room, like you see back east in the old homes, and so I had that all decked out with Elvis, and my father came back from a trip that he went to often on these trips, and he came into my room and he had just bought me a German tape recorder. Nobody had a tape recorder.
Right, a reel-to-reel.
A reel-to-reel tape recorder for me. He used to always bring these wonderful gifts back. And he came into the room, and he looked around, and he said, Mickey, are you a homosexual?
Right, all those Elvises.
And I said, a what? He said, do you like guys? Men? Do you like other boys? Have you had sex with other boys? I said, no, I haven't done any of that.
At least he was open to it.
Yeah. So he says, well, you should take this down. Somebody might think wrongly of you. I said, yeah, but that's Elvis' dad and all the kids. No, I don't, you know. And he comes out with a stack of Playboys.
There you go. Hugh Hefner.
And he said, he said, here, hang these up.
So can you imagine? A father in the 50s giving his kid a stack of Playboys.
I was stunned.
And telling you to hang them up in your room,
no,
naked women.
I was stunned. I was like,
a sex publisher is born.
These women. And then, of course, that opened me up to try to find publications. And I found Betty Page and I found all these people.
Oh, yeah.
So I realized that my father was very supportive of me. And, of course, it was known throughout the Montclair that point that Mickey had dirty, naked pictures.
In his room. So you should have charged admission.
So all the boys now wanted to come to my house. All the girls wanted to come to my house. And as it was, my parents traveled a lot, so I would...
So you had parties.
Now have parties there where we would, you know, dance and kiss and feel each other up.
Right. You know. So you're like 13, 14 at this point?
Yeah.
Okay, so you haven't had sexual intercourse yet. There's like a lot of making out and stuff. Uh-huh. And when did the sexual intercourse come? Or
not till later.
Not until like 15?
Not till I went to Europe.
Europe.
Not till I went back.
So before that, there was your Jewish girl fetish.
Yeah, so my first two things, well, one of the things that changed my life was the day my father came in. And asked me why I had Elvis on the wall.
Yeah.
Rather than these beautiful women. That kind of, I thought, okay, this is cool. The second thing that radicalized me, two other things. One was during the time of Sputnik, when Sputnik was launched and Peyton Place was published. There were two Jewish girls, Bonnie Kellner and Donna Horowitz.
Hi, Bonnie. Hi, Donna.
Hi. I don't know who you are. But Donna wrote a story about a Peyton Place about Montclair Junior High School.
Right. She wrote about all the teachers.
The teachers, our gay teacher.
Parents.
The parents and
who was having affairs.
Because we all knew these things.
Mm.
You know.
But to have it in writing freaks everybody out.
Right. And so I wanted to help them because they had helped me with my homework.
Mm-hmm.
And so I became their publisher.
This was your first publishing foray?
Yes, that was my first publishing. And I would leave the doors to the school open. There were no secure day then, you know. I worked in the shop a lot. I loved to work in the shop. And so I would leave the shop window partially opened. And I would climb in there at night and then go to the secretary's office. And there was the mimeograph machine.
Yeah, there's these people out there, your fans.
Here was the mimeograph machine, and I would mimeograph the chapters. And, of course, they spread throughout the school.
So it was all in purple?
Yeah, it was all in purple. That's right, all in purple. And so finally one night after this got out and everybody was talking about this book that this girl was writing, they set a trap for me. And so I got caught in the secretary's room.
Wow, your first bust.
Yeah, that was my first bust, yeah. And the second event that took place, and it's very related. They have to be a little quiet out here, though.
Quiet down, everybody.
The second event that took place, and then we'll stop it there, was the shaming of this beautiful, very wealthy girl that lived in Montclair. But she liked to put out, as they said.
Mm. Mm. She was not a Jewish girl.
No, she was nice.
An Italian girl.
I think she was Italian. No, she was WASP. She was a WASP. And anyway, so she would have sex with the boys, not intercourse, but, you know, mainly give blowjobs.
Did she give you one?
No, never.
No.
Nope. I was her protector, actually. So
you didn't get paid in blowjobs?
No, they called us into the assembly. And Mr. Edgerton, who was the, bless your soul, because I know you're dead. Mr. Edgerton, who was the principal, really got up in front of everybody and said that this girl, you couldn't walk this girl to school.
Nobody.
Or home. You couldn't go to her house. And if you did, you would be suspended.
Nobody was allowed.
No.
Girls or guys?
Guys.
Guys were not allowed.
So, I was like, I didn't believe what had just happened, okay? It couldn't happen today, I don't think. But
There are variations. It was a form of slut shaming.
Slut shaming,
and
yeah.
There are other forms that happen. I don't think they could forbid you from going to her house.
No, but of course not. They couldn't forbid me from walking her home either.
But they could suspend her.
Yeah, and me. I went home and told my father this. And he was outraged. He said, "This is terrible. This is terrible, Mickey. And you need to walk her home."
Aw.
"You need to walk her home." So then he kind of made a joke. He said, "You might also get a blowjob."
Did you?
No.
Aw. But you've always been a protector of sluts.
Yeah, always, yeah.
So when was your first blowjob?
I grew up with him. long time after that.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
So are we going over?
Anyway, yeah, so my father.
To Italy.
Yeah. My father came to the school, read Mr. Edgerton a riot act.
Yeah.
About this kind of thing, and I was reinstated, you know. But I was constantly in trouble. You know, I didn't like math.
He gave you a cigarette in the middle of the meeting.
Yeah, he did. Yeah. He gave me a cigarette in the middle of the meeting, which today would be.
Well, that you couldn't do today.
No, you couldn't do that today.
I mean, but it was kind of ballsy to do even then.
It was ballsy, and Mr. Edgerton, the principal, was kind of taken back.
Yeah.
But he didn't say anything.
So. Okay, so I mean, there's a lot more New Jersey stories, but
endless. So I think we can continue. Some.
Yeah, we're going to fill in a lot of blanks later. This is going to take a while, this autobiography or biography. But let's skip ahead to first sex, which would be in Italy. So your mom and your dad separated, and that's when dad got together with this Brigitte Bardot lookalike.
Yeah.
BB.
Yeah.
That you had pillow fights with.
Right. Little German girl.
Mm-hmm.
She's 3 years older than I am.
Right. And she was your...
I loved her. She
your
was
stepmother.
So I never had sex with her. We just had a pillow fight or two when Dad was away.
But first sex.
First sex.
You're trying to figure out when it was.
Well, there were two things. I don't know if I call it sex. One, when I went to my one and only hooker.
Oh, yeah. This is where you had sex basically on the stairs with yourself.
Yeah, that's correct. I never made it up to her room to have sex.
Aw.
Yeah, you know, but she washed me, cleaned me all up in a bidet, and didn't charge me full price. She was very... very, very nice.
Yeah.
I was very embarrassed because I was a stalking 6-foot-tall 15-year-old kid. So I looked much older than I actually was. And then the the real first sex that I had was in Germany with a chambermaid.
A chambermaid?
Yes, which my father arranged. She was also kind of a hooker.
Right.
And so my father got me a date with this girl.
And how did that one go?
So we went out to dinner, and then we went by the river. It might have been the Rhine River, and we had sex on a bench.
Wow.
On a park bench.
That's pretty raw.
So that was pretty raw, and it was pretty early in the evening.
Doesn't sound comfortable.
It was cold.
Cold and early in the evening?
Early.
On a park bench.
Couldn't
your father have gotten you a hotel room?
It was around 10 o'clock. Well, that was the idea, but we never made it back to the hotel. And
so you were kind of hot for each other?
Yeah.
Is that why you did it in the park bench?
I don't remember why we did it on a park bench, but I got back to the hotel early.
Yeah.
And I snuck in to the room. My room was right next to my parents' room. And I snuck in there and I was changing and getting ready for bed. And my father opens the door and turns on the light. And he says, "Congratulations, how was it? I said, how was what? He says, come on, you're home early. You already had sex, didn't you? I said, yeah.
Aw.
How was that? I said, oh, it was okay. It was good.
Yeah. At least you got it in.
Yeah.
And you came there.
And then he says
to
me.
Did you use a rubber? Is that what they called it then? No.
No rubber. And he said to me, did you throw the baby in the river?
The baby?
Yeah. You're not going to have a baby with her, right?
That's the expression, throw the baby in the river.
To me, did you
that,
throw
that means wearing a rubber?
Yes, yeah.
Oh, okay.
And I said, no.
No, there could be a baby.
Could be a baby.
And you.
Anyway, that was my real first. That was my real. But from then on, when I moved to Europe, I had more sex than I could count because I worked in the theater and the chorus girls.
Speaking of chorus girls, there's all these girls out here. There's a bunch of girls.
A bunch of girls?
Yeah, there are a bunch of girls.
So, all right. So I think we should continue this next week if they're girls.
Well, I mean, they're circulating around. They look like they want to express themselves for your birthday.
Yeah.
Should we invite them in? I don't know.
Let's close this in some kind of
fashion. Well, okay, so you know what? We have gotten up to basically age 15.
Yeah.
Because your first sex led to a lot more sex, and acting in the theater, which of course always leads to a lot of sex. And that was, something that made a big impression on you because you've been in the theater ever since.
Yeah.
And then you went... I don't know. You came back here. I actually don't know what happened much there. You know, and then you went out to Los Angeles, did a bunch of odd jobs.
Went back and forth for
a while. Collection business. Yeah. Married Susan number one, and I can never forgive her for having my name, but she did. And then, of course, Paul Eberle. Collection business, Paul Eberle.
Newspapers.
And the L.A. Star.
And
I have this picture of... of the L.A. Star, right? This is the L.A. Star?
That's the L.A.
These
Star.
These are the people in the L.A. Star. Here we go. Yeah. And where are you? You're in the back, of course.
You can see me. I have my hand across my heart, as I often do.
Yeah, right in the middle. Looking kind of Jesus-like, huh?
My long
here
hair.
Here we go. I'm going to kind of push.
Careful. Yeah, you got the lights in. It's okay.
Yeah, there he is. That's okay,
better.
Right?
Yeah.
Whoops.
Right there.
That's Mickey.
Yeah.
There's Paul Eberle right there.
The big tall girl.
And there is Willem de Ridder.
Above her, above him is Susan. Queen Adrina.
Queen
Adrina ran the first commercial phone sex service in the country. And 15 days after she started it, the FBI came to shut her down for obscenity across state lines.
Anybody else we should know about here?
Let's see here. Well, there's several people there, but anyway, yeah.
All right, well, we'll get into them later, I guess.
Yeah.
So then, L.A. Starr, Willem de Ridder, Annie Sprinkle, and Veronica Vera, famous artists like Dan O'Bannon in
L.A.
Starr.
Who, of course, was the producer and writer of Alien.
Right, and he did drawings.
Bukowski.
Charles Bukowski.
Yeah, many of the people. And two of the reviewers, and I don't really remember their name or the company they started, but they were 18 years old. They started a record company, which became one of the largest record companies in the world.
There you go. So, you know, there were all kinds of arrests and police raids, and you were always pushing the edge of what was acceptable to put on street corners in news racks.
Which today would be ridiculous.
Yeah, yeah.
Ridiculous.
And then you published Love, Hate, Finger, God. What am I leaving out?
L.A. Starr.
Well, no, I said L.A. Starr. Yeah, but those magazines that you were publishing more in Europe.
Yeah.
And then you were doing radio shows.
I started on pirate radio, yeah, in Europe.
In Europe.
Yep.
And then somehow you went back and forth to Rhode Island at Ezra Pound's house.
Right.
Pounding out some more magazines.
Yeah, pounding out more magazines.
Annie Sprinkle Hot Shit. And then Woodstock, New York.
That's in Woodstock, New York, after I came back as a fugitive.
So you're fugitive run and on.
I was a fugitive for good parts of my
life. One of the things for a magazine that showed Annie Sprinkle having sex with Long Jean Silver and her stump, which was considered illegal to show.
Right.
A person who didn't have a leg, didn't have a foot, basically, using her amputated leg to give pleasure to Miss Annie Sprinkle, now Dr. Annie Sprinkle.
Yep. So.
And various other things that really.
I was prosecuted for corporate espionage. I was prosecuted for criminal libel. I was prosecuted for various obscenities. But two of our great, great victories. One was the Angie Dickinson case.
Did Barry Fisher work on that?
Barry Fisher, yes, and his team.
And Stanley Fleischman.
Yeah, they defended us through all of this. But that was a big, big case for us. We overturned the criminal libel statutes in the state of California, which meant they fell in many other states. And the criminal libel statutes meant that you could be arrested for criminal libel if you said something about someone else that basically they didn't like.
Right.
Okay.
Now you
because
can't.
Because the law was passed in 18-something to protect senators and people like that. So we won that case. It was only the second time that it was used in the United States. The first time it was used against Confidential magazine. And it broke them. We were hippies, so they had nothing to break. And then the second case that was a major, major case was the Newsrack case, which when we started putting Newsracks out there, they said that we couldn't have our Newsracks out on the street. And so we went to court. And we said, well, look, if the Los Angeles Times can have news racks out there, then we can have news racks out there. And if we can't have news racks out there, so neither can the LA Times. And the LA Times immediately saw the threat. And they came in on our side. And they said, no.
All they right.
They have the right, like us and like any newspaper, to be in news racks.
Those were in the days when the mainstream media would stick by the the sex media.
Yeah, absolutely.
Just so, like a lot of mainstream actors were standing by the producers of Deep Throat.
Yeah. So that case, which the court ruled in our favor and said that we could have access, mm-hmm. like anybody else, was a major case several years later when pay television came along. Pay television came along, and there was big votes about it. People didn't want it. They didn't know what it was, any of that. And pay television sued the city of Los Angeles. And they said, if these other stations have access to these homes, everybody's home, mm-hmm. then we also have access. You have to give us access. You have to give pay television access to every home in Los Angeles.
Mm-hmm.
And they brought up a case. They brought up the news rack case.
There you go.
And they said, look, if newspapers have to have the right to access, we also have to have the right to access. And they won the case, and pay television came along.
So
it probably would have come along anyway, but that
well,
was
but
the
you
initial
were part of the history.
That was the initial thing.
And yeah, you were.
That's also how
a pioneer.
That's also how a public access came along, because what they said, what the government said then, said, okay, we'll give you access to the utility lines and all of that so that you can get into people's homes. But those cross private property. And therefore, you must create channels for the people of Los Angeles.
Mm-hmm.
And so the feds and so forth, basically they created public access.
So your father gave you a foot fetish, right?
My father, yeah, he was crazy about feet. He would always comment if he saw ugly feet. He loved feet.
Aren't you going to shake my foot's hand?
Yeah, hi, darling foot.
No, wait, farther along. Wait, no. It's
watch
not,
it.
It's
there's a fire under there.
Mm.
Okay, so.
So then, prison.
Yeah, it's almost,
Right, well, you talk about that a lot. Then, of course, you came out and you came to Beverly Hills, and that's when you met Ellen, your second
wife.
Well,
there's a lot before that, and I don't really want to even go into that right now.
But that's when you met me.
Yeah, right.
Right.
But before that, there was a lot going
there's
on.
There's a lot. There's so much. We're trying to skip ahead.
Yeah.
But did I leave out something that you want to mention?
Yeah, lots.
A lot. I know, but we have to skip ahead
okay,
to the...
Okay, let's just stop
okay,
now.
So, but
we'll pick it up some other time.
I just want to show some of the things I
sure.
brought along.
Mm-hmm.
This is Meetings with Remarkable People.
Mm-hmm.
Which was one of your magazines that you
That's
did
correct.
When you first got out of prison. And then we have here, what is this?
Beverly Hills the magazine.
Beverly Hills the magazine. And here's a copy of the Brentwood Blah Blah. And these were two of your magazines that you published when you got out and became like a preeminent publisher on the West Side.
I was the iconic publisher of the West Side, yes. As a matter of fact, I was just looking on the internet the other day because I knew we were going to talk about some of these things, and suddenly there are a ton of articles about the Brentwood Blah Blah and how it was started and how much we sold it for and all the problems we caused for the other newspapers and magazines and that kind of thing. So it's very exciting to see that part of the history coming out.
It is.
When a few years ago there was nothing about the papers on there, but now There's a lot of stuff.
Then, of course, you sold the magazine, and then to your partners, the Pages, and then they kind of drove it into the ground.
Yes.
But in the midst of that...
Didn't take them long.
We produced Desert Susan.
Right.
And fell in love.
Yes.
And then we got married. Here we are. So, we're kind of bringing ourselves up to the present.
Yeah.
Here's the captain and first mate. And you know, now we've got this ship.
Right.
This institute.
But
this
we forgot
speakeasy.
A whole part of the adventure.
Well, I know. It's not that I forgot. It's that I'm trying to skip ahead.
Okay, so let's just stop. We'll do it another day.
Okay,
that's
well,
fine.
We are going to, but
okay.
We're skipping ahead to
okay.
New Bonoboville,
okay.
Which looks like a ship.
Right.
We're here, and we're celebrating your birthday and 42 years of revolutionary publishing with Prince Max. And so, you people that were hovering around, you can come in now for the last few minutes. Coming. They're coming in.
Okay, I'm going to...
You're
going to
go.
Excuse
now.
Myself.
Oh,
yes.
Now, no, wait a second. But what? This is the part where you're supposed to stay. It's only
what?
5 more minutes. Why are you excusing yourself?
Because...
You've been here the whole time, Max. You can live for a few more moments.
Okay. Okay, well, where are you guys? Come on in. Here we go. And happy birthday to you. Come on in. Happy birthday to you. Happy birthday, dear Massimo. Happy birthday to you.
Real classy guy. Classy cake for a real classy guy.
After that story in Montclair, New Jersey, that looks a little strange.
Yeah.
Take off all the cleanups, Susie.
We'll bring the tissue. Okay.
All right.
Blow, baby, blow. Put your lips
ready?
Together.
Yay!
Pretty good.
All right. All right, so those of you who are listening on radio, we've been blowing out candles. Mm. And now there's the whipped cream.
Okay. Mm. Eat all of Max's cream, Dr. Susie.
Oh.
Mm, happy birthday, honey.
Thank you. Love you.
Love you, sweetheart. Okay,
all
so...
Right.
What is your wisdom to leave us with in on your
my wisdom,
big 7-0?
My wisdom is that my basic wisdom, I live by very simple rules. One of them is a saying that goes like this: the ideal is the enemy of the real.
That's a good one.
So we have created an ideal that has nothing to do with our reality.
So if you want to have fun, accept reality.
Reality is much more fun, much
Although
more interesting.
Although fantasy is kind of fun too.
No, I'm talking about ideal.
Right.
Ideal meaning, ideal is
expecting
really...
Expecting too much.
Yeah, ideal is really fascism. This is the way it should be.
Well, don't expect too much of this card, but it's from all of us here in
Bonoboville. And the next thing that I always talk about is the goal is the journey.
Gurdjieff.
Gurdjieff. Yeah. Mm-hmm. That's basic stuff. If you have a shitty journey... Fuck the goal. The goal's useless.
Because the journey takes a lot longer than the goal.
All right, and now I'm going to open the envelope.
The envelope, please. Here we go. Brum-bum-bum. Captain Max's birthday.
All right.
It sings.
Oh, it sings.
What does it say?
Sing.
What does it say? Everybody wants you to read it.
Oh,
Is that someone like drinking beer and belching, or? I did not buy this card. Okay, this is a Bonoboville card from the heart and the throat. Well, making you dance.
Worst case scenario.
All right.
Happy birthday, sweetie.
Thank you, darling.
And, look, you got some Kettle One.
That's Kettle One.
Wow. All right, so we're just about done. It looks like we're ready to party and lick whipped cream off of each other. So thank you, Captain Max, for sharing just a small part of your story with
us. Just a small little part.
Just a small. You've got such a big story.
Just a small little part.
And that's really all we have in life, huh? Stories.
Yep, that's all we're left
with. We have
with
our story, and it's made up of multiple stories that intersect with other people's stories.
That's what we're left with.
And your story intersects with mine, although this time we really devoted it to yours.
Okay, it's midnight.
All right, it's midnight, so...
Time to go.
Thank you, Bonoboville, everybody here. Trixie, Abe, Mar, I can't name everybody, but I want to thank you for... putting it all together tonight, and we're going to party soon. Thank you, my darling listener, for having us in your mansion on a hill or your cardboard box or your ship. Ahoy there. Set sail. The goal is the journey. The ideal is the enemy of the real. So have some fun in reality. Take that adventure voyage that you've always wanted to take. Make like bonobos, not baboons. Make love, not war. Make love to someone you love tonight, even if that someone is you. I love you. Max loves you too. Say I love you.
I love you. And from our house to your house, thank you for having us. And remember, revolution every morning when you look in the mirror.
And thank you, Condomania.
Yeah. You need to talk with someone about something you can't talk about with anyone else? You can talk to us. I'm Dr. Susan Block, your mistress of the airwaves.
Good.
But my day job is director of the Dr. Susan Block Institute for the Erotic Arts and Sciences, specializing in sex therapy over the phone. Anytime you need to talk, whether you need serious psychotherapy or a hot phone sex experience or a combination, my world-renowned telephone sex therapists are just a phone call away. Totally private, absolutely confidential. We listen, talk with you, advise you, role-play for you, fantasize with you. No fantasy is too taboo, and help you with anything from impotence to exhibitionism, fears to desires, fetishes to marriages. For more information, call us at 213-291-9497. That's 213-291-9497 anytime you need to talk.